If it's a matchup between Biden and Trump, I know exactly where I'd go. I would go with Joe Manchin.
Senator Lisa Murkowski eyes an alternative to a rematch of the 2020 election. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 24th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, cruise ship passengers in Southeast contribute to electric heat pumps that reduce emissions.
That is a big chunk of our community that could reassess how our buildings are heated in a renewable and sustainable way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
The bodies of three state workers and a pilot who died in a helicopter crash on the North Slope Thursday have been recovered. The North Slope Police Department identifies the dead as Alaska Department of Natural Resources Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey staff members, 51-year-old Ronald Dannon and 27-year-old Justin Herman, both of Fairbanks, and 26-year-old Tori Moore of South Bend, Indiana, and the helicopter's pilot, 48-year-old Bernard Tony Higdon of North Pole. An Alaska State Trooper dispatch says their remains were recovered Sunday from a tundra lake where the maritime helicopter zone Bell 206 went down July 20th, about 50 miles outside of Utqiagvik, while transporting the DNR staff members for field work. North Slope Police and Search and Rescue Team members assisted the Alaska Dive Search, Rescue, and Recovery Team in the recovery operation. The cause of the crash is being investigated by the National Transportation Safety Board, and efforts to remove the wreckage from the lake are underway. The bodies are being sent to the State Medical Examiner's Office for autopsy. Next of kin have been notified. Meanwhile, Senator Lisa Murkowski says she'd consider supporting Democratic Senator Joe Manchin for U.S. president next year.
If it's a matchup between Biden and Trump, I know exactly where I'd go. I would go with Joe Manchin.
Murkowski spoke on last week's episode of the PBS show Firing Line. Murkowski is one of only seven Republican senators who voted to convict former President Trump after his second indictment in 2021. In the PBS interview, she said other Republican candidates appear promising, including Tim Scott and Nikki Haley, but Murkowski made it clear that she believes Trump is unqualified.
In my view, this former president incited an insurrection on the Capitol. To me, It should be done. It should be over. But apparently for many Republicans in this country, they have chosen to look beyond that.
West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin is an ally of Murkowski's, particularly on energy issues. He hasn't announced he's running for president, but he participated in a forum Monday in New Hampshire for a group called No Labels that is pushing the idea of a unity ticket or a third option for president. Many Democrats see it as a backdoor effort to split the left, ensuring that Trump returns to the White House. While Murkowski says she's preferring Manchin over President Joe Biden, Murkowski also said she'd have to do some, quote, serious evaluation to ensure supporting a third-party candidate wouldn't lead to a second term for Trump. Meanwhile, tourism brings more than a million people to Southeast Alaska every year, and though that generates a lot of revenue for the community, it also brings a cost in the form of greenhouse gas emissions. To address that, one of the region's largest tour companies has launched a unique and local carbon offset program. KTOO's Anna Canny has the story.
Tourism in Southeast Alaska largely runs on fossil fuels. On a busy afternoon in downtown Juneau, a crowd of tourists pour off a cruise ship. Tour guides in brightly colored jackets are controlling the chaos, directing visitors to their whale watches or glacier tours. They're shuttled off by the hundreds on diesel-powered buses. Then, they'll board diesel-powered helicopters, float planes, or boats. So each tour releases greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. To make up for that, Sitka-based Allen Marine Tours is collecting donations from tourists. The money will go towards installing heat pumps across Southeast Alaska. Electric heat pumps in the region run on hydropower, and they're a popular alternative to heating oil. That means they have huge potential to cut local greenhouse gas emissions. But they're expensive. Al Marine's Caitlin Ellis says they hope the program will eventually generate thousands of dollars in donations.
That's a lot of heat pumps. That is a big chunk of our community that could reassess how our buildings are heated in a renewable and sustainable way.
The program will be facilitated through a partnership with the local nonprofit Juno Carbon Offset. They finance heat pumps for lower-income families in the region. The bulk of Allen Marine's passengers come from cruise ships. Now they'll have the option to donate $2 at the gift shop on board.
It's kind of similar to like a grocery store roundup.
Some passengers are independent travelers who book online, and those people will automatically be charged the $2 fee unless they opt out. But the majority of tourists book through cruise lines instead, and that means much of this program's success will rely on onboard advertising, which is tricky for Allen Marine tour guides.
We don't want to overwhelm them with information while they're having a great time.
Ellis said the way they advertise the program will have to be refined in future years. Training and recruitment efforts will help their tour guides find new ways to talk about climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. For now, the money is trickling in.
At the end of the season, we'll have a very clear picture, but we do have money coming in. Very hopeful that at least one heat pump is going to be purchased this year.
But this program's success could give new insight into how tourists can further climate action in the Southeast communities they visit. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Anchorage Assembly members say they're concerned about a challenge lodged by one of Mayor Dave Bronson's former chiefs of staff over this year's municipal election. Sammy Graham cited an internal IT policy in her April 11th complaint. That policy was finalized the day of her complaint, a week after Election Day. The mayor's office said it didn't know the policy existed. Assemblymember Chris Constant questioned at a work session Friday how and why Graham got the policy.
We are looking into what reasonably might appear to be a coordinated effort to affect the outcome of an election.
Graham filed her complaint as votes were still being tallied. She alleges the city violated the new IT policy, which would require that an IT staff member be present or give approval for all insertions of USB devices into, quote, critical municipal computers. Constant criticized the policy, calling it, quote, absurd.
There are any number of departments, like the Department of Law, which is dealing with privileged information all of the time, who are not going to have an unsworn IT staff member overseeing the transfer of records between their computers, having access to their flash drives and their documents that are privileged.
Emails received in a records request filed by the Assembly show that the policy cited by Graham was not public at the time of her complaint and had been sent to her directly by the city's IT director, Mark Dahl. Bronson Chief of Staff Mario Byrd says the mayor's office did not find out about this policy or Graham's election challenge until it was reported on by the Anchorage Daily News. He says the policy did not go through the traditional channels for approval of new policies.
What appears to have happened here was an internal policy that was improperly communicated. That is what we have reviewed as soon as it was brought to our attention by the media. Yes, based on what I see here and the internal discussions that we've had, it was improper.
It's unclear what led Dahl to email the internal policy to Graham, who at the time was a private citizen and serving as an election observer for a conservative assembly candidate who ended up losing. Bronson officials say that Dahl remains a municipal employee and he is currently on administrative leave. Municipal Ombudsman Daryl Hess says he's investigating the incident and hopes to have a final report within the next 2 weeks. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg's museum details how a tent city of cannery workers helped shape the community.
History of people moving to town and discovering this place and realizing, you know, what a gem it is.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life, getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope, there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share-your-strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Smoke from wildfires burning across Canada is reaching South Central and Interior Alaska this week. National Weather Service meteorologist Sam Shea says Anchorage residents will see a milky haze starting Tuesday from fires burning hundreds of miles away in the Yukon Territory.
We're not expecting a complete obscuration of the mounds like we've seen back when we've had, say the Sockeye fire or something like that, because the fires are so far away.
Northern parts of Alaska will see stronger smoke from the Canadian fires, which densely blanketed East Coast cities earlier this summer.
Probably the worst of the smoke will actually be more towards interior Alaska and north of the Alaska Range, like from Tok north.
The Yukon smoke should leave Anchorage by Wednesday or Thursday, Shea says. Meanwhile, meteorologists are watching for fire potential in Alaska. The Copper River Basin is under a red flag warning overnight today for lightning strikes, which could kickstart what's been a historically calm wildfire season due to cold, wet weather. An Alaska state trooper waited nearly 2 years for a very personal verdict this month. Trooper Bruce Bruggeman was in court when a Homer jury found 61-year-old Brett Herrick guilty of attempting to murder him.
Well, I felt good about it.
In an interview, Bruggeman recounted what happened that August 2021 day in Anchor Point. He says Herrick was wanted on warrants when he was spotted outside a grocery store.
Wore like a black leather trench coat all the time, and he always wore lots of layers, carrying weapons, swords, daggers. He wore a crown of thorns made out of barbed wire.
Two troopers, including Bruggeman, were sent to arrest Herrick. Bruggeman arrived first. Bruggeman says Herrick tried to run when he approached. When Bruggeman tackled him to the ground, Herrick drew a pistol and opened fire.
But he actually had a holster with a bayonet attached to it, too. So he pulled out the gun and he just started popping rounds off at me.
Five rounds struck Bruggeman's left arm and torso, badly wounding him. He pulled out his sidearm and returned fire, but it jammed after two shots, both of which missed. Bruggeman ran around the corner of the building for cover from Herrick.
He's still trying to watch him, and he was trying to come back to finish the job. And I was yelling back at him, and that's when Sergeant Cox came pulling up.
Troopers say Herrick fled, prompting an overnight manhunt before he was arrested. For Bruggeman, the shooting meant months of medical care.
In my left arm, they were going to do an amputation, but they were able to save it. But to save it, they have to do many, many surgeries. I actually kind of lost count.
Bruggeman says he still has nerve damage in his left arm, but he's back to regular duty this summer. Prosecutors say Herrick faces 7 to 99 years in prison on the attempted murder charge at his November 1st sentencing. Challenge Alaska lost adaptive cycling and other equipment worth nearly $100,000 in a robbery at its Anchorage location over the weekend. The organization is a nonprofit that helps people with disabilities participate in sports and outdoor recreation. The stolen equipment was a mix of standard bicycles and specially made cycles for people with disabilities. Nate Boltz is executive director of Challenge Alaska. He says the equipment is used several days a week for different programs.
We have evening rides for individuals with physical disabilities where we meet at various trailheads around Anchorage and just go out cycling for the evening. Some of this equipment is used for our disabled veterans groups. And then, we occasionally do, bigger trips.
Several of the 15 stolen cycles have hand-operated pedals. For that reason, Bolt says they're easy to recognize, and he's asking people to keep an eye out for the stolen equipment. The organization is hoping that the stolen equipment is found. Otherwise, they'll have to fundraise to replace it. Bolt says often it takes 6 months or more to get a new adaptive hand cycle. He says these cycles serve people who otherwise wouldn't have access to them.
All people have a right and a need for recreating. However, the cost of entry into recreation when you live, especially with physical disabilities, is much greater than the cost of entry to everybody else in the public.
Bolt says anyone who has information about the theft can call the Anchorage Police Department. Photos of the missing cycles are posted on Challenge Alaska's Facebook page. Meanwhile, lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are currently negotiating the details of this year's Farm Bill reauthorization, and Senator Lisa Murkowski says Alaska's commercial fishermen could see a boost from the bill. The senator introduced legislation last week that would prioritize food security and small-scale food producers in the state, including Alaska's seafood industry.
Our seafood industry deserves to have some level of parity with our farmers. As we're looking to feed people in this country, let's not overlook the extraordinary value of what comes from our oceans.
The Farm Bill is a sweeping umbrella of laws administered through the Department of Agriculture. It directs national agriculture and food policies and is reauthorized every 5 years. The current version of the Farm Bill is set to expire this fall. Murkowski's legislation would expand grant programs currently available for farmers and ranchers to commercial fishermen and shoreside processors. It would also add labeling requirements for genetically modified or lab-cultivated fish. The bill also creates a Wild USA Seafood label for fish harvested in U.S. waters. Murkowski says the goal is to promote Alaska seafood on the international market.
People are willing to pay a higher premium for the wild-caught fish that they get out of Alaska. They know that it is, quote, the good stuff.
This is the second time Murkowski has introduced Alaska-specific legislation to the federal Farm Bill. The senator introduced a micro-grant program to address food security in the state during the last reauthorization. Murkowski was one of 13 senators who ultimately voted against the Farm Bill passed by Congress in 2018, at the time saying the final version did not include, quote, meaningful forest management reforms, a roadless rule exemption for Alaska, or other important state priorities.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud, drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
Alyeska Resort in Girdwood has a new attraction, the Veilbreaker Sky Bridges. People can pay to walk 600 feet across two narrow bridges suspended 2,500 feet above the valley floor. Mountain General Manager Dwayne Stutzman says demand has been high since the July 10th opening.
Overwhelming. Exceeded expectations is the best way I could tell it. We opened up on Monday and we're hoping that we would get three or four people per tour. We do four a day and they're selling out.
Stutzman says they're training more guides next week and plan on increasing the number of tours each day. Right now, tours are every 2 hours, six people each. It costs $150 per person. Stutzman says it's an experience most other resorts don't have.
You know, a lot of resorts will do a zip line or roller coaster, but he wanted something different that really showed what the Alaska lifestyle was all about.
The tour begins with a tram ride up the mountain. At the top, people are equipped with harnesses and helmets and given a safety briefing. The guides take the group up a short but relatively steep hike to the bridges, where they are clipped into the safety cable and cross at their own pace, one or two at a time. Visitors are welcome to take pictures on the bridges, but the guides say if they drop their phones, they won't be getting them back. Ryan Merrill, a self-described adrenaline junkie from Ohio, says it was more intense than he was expecting.
So initially it's not bad, but you get out to the middle, you can really feel the bounce of it. You know, you're looking down at your feet, and it's just straight down.
But he says the view made it all worthwhile. The Mendenhall Glacier is one of Southeast Alaska's most visited tourist attractions, but midway through the region's busiest ever tourist season, it's already reached its capacity for commercial tours. As KTOO's Katie Anastas reports, tourists are now using Juneau's city bus to get there.
If you're visiting Juneau on a cruise and want to see the Mendenhall Glacier, you'll probably want to book a tour. Tour buses take passengers straight to the glacier in about half an hour. You could take the city bus. At $2 per person, it's a fraction of the price of a commercial tour. But the closest stop is 1.5 miles away. Those were the factors Ron Verhill and his wife Lucy were weighing when they got off their cruise ship this morning.
I wanted to take the city bus because I wanted to save some money. And Lucy wanted to, she wanted to take a tour bus. So we're still kind of not on the fence about which way we're going to go.
But they quickly learned that the tour bus was not going to be an option for them. so by late afternoon, they were on the city bus. It had taken up most of their day in Juneau.
Well, the bus is a bit of a milk run, but it was okay. We had a long walk. That long walk and about 1.5 kilometer or miles.
The U.S. Forest Service allows more than 500,000 people to visit the glacier on commercial tours each season. Usually, companies have enough permits to sell same-day tours throughout the summer. But now, halfway through what's shaping up to be Juneau's biggest tourist season yet, they've already sold out. That's driven more tourists to take the city bus. And the higher demand is taking a toll on Juneau residents. Drivers report leaving up to 29 people at stops because their buses are too full. Alexandra Pierce is the city and borough of Juneau's tourism manager.
Yeah, I've heard anecdotally about people not being picked up at Fred Meyer with their groceries, say, or somebody missing a flight because they were relying on the city bus to make their plane connection.
But Pierce says the city can't prevent tourists from taking public transportation.
Like, if you or I go to New York and ride the subway or London and ride the tube, you know, we wouldn't get a little stop on the turnstile that says, oh, you don't live here. And it's the same thing here. Public transit is available to everybody and needs to be available to everybody.
If Capital Transit has spare drivers, it can add more buses to popular routes. But with a statewide driver shortage straining both the city and tour companies, that can't happen often enough to meet the demand. At a Juneau Assembly meeting earlier this month, member Michelle Hale urged city leaders to find a solution.
Often, the people that ride the bus are some of our most poor citizens, not always, of course, and might not have access to even figure out who to make that complaint to.
In an effort to reduce pressure on the bus system, the city has issued additional permits for the parking lot by the Brotherhood Bridge. Tour companies are taking tourists there to see the glacier from a distance. The city has also hired a consultant to help figure out how Capital Transit can meet the needs of residents and tourists during the season. Pierce says the strain on public transportation points to key challenges Juneau faces when it comes to tourism.
We have a shore excursion supply and demand problem in Juneau. If I could characterize simply our two biggest tourism issues, it's a volume problem. There are just a lot of people, and there's a supply and demand problem that we are running out of having enough things for those people to do. We've always been a destination where there's a lot of options and a lot to do, but we just have too many people now.
She says the consultants should have recommendations ready for city leaders next month. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
For decades, Petersburg's aptly named Tent City provided shelter for a rotating cast of transient workers and adventurers. Some of them stayed in Petersburg and made it their permanent home. A new exhibit at the Clausen Memorial Museum looks at the ways that the campground impacted both the economy and the character of the town. KFSK's Hannah Floor has the story.
Hi, Lewis. Are you ready?
Sled dog Louie comes through the gate, ready to race around looping gravel trails. Nearby, another dog, Ozzy, nuzzles skunk cabbage. We're more than a mile and a half from downtown Petersburg at a fenced dog park run by Petersburg's Humane Association.
Ozzy! Come on!
But this place wasn't always a dog park. In the 80s and 90s, it was a campground known as Tent City. The economy of Petersburg has long relied on fish. But before fish processing plants had bunkhouses for their employees, cannery workers had a tough time finding lodging during the fishing season. In 1980, the city of Petersburg decided to address the housing problem by building 26 tent platforms, restrooms, and a cooking pavilion on a chunk of land between Sandy Beach and the airport. A month after the campground opened in the summer of 1981, it was full. Heidi Lee lived in a school bus just down the hill from Tent City.
So many people came here from all over the world and had a big experience.
The museum exhibit takes visitors on a tour through the 20-plus years of Tent City's existence. A blue tarp hangs from the ceiling, mimicking the shelters built on each tent platform. There are photos of campers, of course, but also the camp cat, named the Mayor of Tent City. There's a bunch of silverware found under tent platforms when the campground was dismantled. Another common find? Earplugs. Don Perry managed the campground in the late 90s.
There's somebody asleep
depending upon what the shift they're on, every minute of the day. There's people in there sleeping because some work days, some work nights.
The campground had its own culture, one that was a little more wild and woolly than that of Petersburg. Don Perry says that although not everyone at Tent City was wonderful, it was filled with all kinds. He loved the job of managing the campground.
It was fun. And it's the people that made it fun. Wasn't me. It just wasn't me, but they made it fun.
He tells a story about a man from New York who was a little out of his element. He came to Petersburg to work for PFI. The processing plant had donated a sleeping bag for him to use at the campground.
And he says, what do I do with this? He said, do I lay on top of it? Do I lay under it? I says, well, you just unzip it and you crawl in it. And I unzipped it for him. He crawled in. And it was amazing how many people out there that had never slept in a sleeping bag.
The constant rain made Tent City life soggy. Hours at the cannery were long. Those unwilling to hitchhike or pay cab fare into town often had to walk or bike to and from work in bad weather. In the late 90s, processing plants started to build bunkhouses for their employees. By the early 2000s, Tent City was no longer financially viable. And in 2003, the Petersburg City Council voted unanimously to close the campground. After lying vacant for nearly a decade, the borough voted to give the Petersburg Humane Association permission to use the land. Heidi Lee loves that the museum has an exhibit focusing on the campground.
It was our kind of more recent history of people moving to town and discovering this place and realizing, you know, what a gem it is. It's fun to see people fall in love with this place because it gives us new appreciation for it, you know.
Outgoing museum director Cindy Lagadakis says the exhibit has helped her understand just how much Tent City was a part of life in Petersburg during the 80s and 90s.
Everybody who comes in the door has a story of their own to tell, which is really kind of fun. Some aspect of it that they know about or they experienced. And that's kind of what a museum is about. You know, it's to share information, to share history, to make you think, to kind of have something that you can relate to.
Items continue to be added to the exhibit, which will be up through the end of summer. In Petersburg, I'm Hannah Flohr.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin, Chris Clint, Rachel Cassandra, and Dev Hardiker in Anchorage, Anna Canny and Katie Anastas in Juneau, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, and Hannah Flohr in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.